This Washington Post Live podcast is sponsored by Siemens, ingenuity for life.
You're listening to a podcast from Washington Post Live, bringing the Post's newsroom to life on stage. On November 8th, eBay CEO Devin Wenig, three of President Trump's key technology policy advisors, and Silicon Valley Congressman Ro Khanna joined other policymakers and experts live at the Washington Post to discuss the promise of new technologies like artificial intelligence, quantum computing, and 3D printing. In this segment, Congressman Ro Khanna of California, DARPA's Valerie Browning, and executives from 3D printing company Formlabs and quantum computing firm IonQ discuss opportunities and challenges that these new technologies face on the marketplace in a climate of regulatory uncertainty. Let's listen.
Well, hello, everyone. Thank you so much for being here today. I'm Kat Zakreski, and I'm the anchor of the upcoming Tech 202 newsletter here at The Post. And we've got a great panel. So I'd like to welcome them all. Thank you for being here this morning. So we'll start with Jungsung Kim, and he's the co-founder and chief strategy officer at IonQ, a quantum computing firm. We also have David Lakatos, chief product officer at the 3D printing company Formlabs. We have Valerie Browning, director of the Defense Sciences Offices at DARPA, and Congressman Ro Khanna, a Democrat from California who represents Silicon Valley. And just before we get started with our conversation today, I wanted to remind you all to tweet any questions that you might have with the hashtag 202Live. So just to kick things off, since we're coming right off the midterm elections, Congressman, it's been a big week for the Democrats here in D.C. Could you tell us a little bit about what some of the priorities might be for Democrats on tech policy now that you have control of the House again?
Sure. Well, it's an honor to be on the panel. I'm surprised you start with the politician as opposed to the technologist, but I'm happy to answer the question. I think there are three things we need to do. One, we need to make sure every person in the nation has access to the internet. There's still so many Americans who don't have access to high-speed internet. China has almost 54% fiber, high-speed internet. We have about 3% fiber. For about $80 billion, you could hook up most of America to the high-speed internet. Second, I think there's going to be, again, issues around net neutrality and getting back to Tom Wheeler's order and not Ajit Pai's reversal on net neutrality. Third, there's going to be a discussion on privacy to make sure that I had proposed an Internet Bill of Rights, but to make sure that people's data is protected online and that they have opportunities to express themselves and equal access online. And finally, I would say there will be a focus on the new types of jobs that are going to take place. I mean, I know this panel is partly about artificial intelligence. It's going to create extraordinary opportunities. When you think about automatic landing systems in planes, I'm very glad we have them. It's led to a lot less crashes, but it's changed the nature of work. And we need to think about what are the new opportunities that are going to come about and how do we prepare people for a digital age.
And so on that point of the new opportunities that might come up, I want to turn it over to some of our representatives from the industry. And so, Jungsung, maybe could you talk to us a little bit about what's happening with quantum computing in Washington right now and what conversations are looking like with lawmakers on that issue?
Absolutely. So quantum computing is a very nascent industry in the sense that it was very much embedded in the R&D community for the last couple of decades. And only in the last maybe 3 or 4 years, people have started to convince themselves that we may be able to build a machine that will be able to help solve some of the very difficult problems, mathematical and scientific problems we face today. And the growth and fruition of this industry really depends on the attraction and training of talent that continues to fuel the progress. It is still remains a very challenging problem, although it's an extremely promising industry. So how do we work together between the industry that's just budding with academic institutions, national laboratories. How do we all work together to create a positive environment to attract and continue to fuel this industry? I think that will be the biggest challenge and opportunity at the same time.
And so I'm just curious on from your perspective, there's a lot of criticism in Silicon Valley about the level of understanding of technology issues in Congress and in other regulatory agencies. How much effort do you see lawmakers making to understand quantum computing right now?
I think quantum computing is a very tricky technological base. I mean, it only took me about 15 years to really appreciate what it does. but at the same time, you know, when we program and use computers today, we don't have to understand how the semiconductor electrons in transistors operate. We have to understand its implications, opportunities, and then how do we actually make sure that we have the talent and the industry support to get it going. So in that sense, I think there has been a tremendous amount of reception from the Hill and also from the administration, past and current, to recognize the importance and potential of the industry to make an effort to support.
And so, Valerie, I just wanted to ask you, you know, with some of the tech hearings we've had this year, people in Washington get a rep for not understanding how some of these platforms work, but actually DARPA has done so much of the work on innovation that we see coming out of the tech sector. And so I just wanted to ask you, what are some of DARPA's priorities right now when it comes to technology?
Sure. So DARPA's portfolio right now is addressing sort of four core mission areas. First is to defend the homeland. So we're looking there at weapons of mass destruction, weapons of mass terror, technologies defend against that, technologies defend against cyber defense. There's deter and prevail against peer adversaries. So there we're looking to leverage complexity and new technologies to surprise the adversary, our peer adversaries, across multiple domains that have expanded to include space and cyber, in addition to land, sea, and air. And then there's technologies to allow us to effectively prosecute stabilization efforts. So technologies that allow us to do peacekeeping and other missions in complex urban environments against hybrid warfare and gray zone tactics, those sorts of things. And then the final mission area is foundational R&D that supports all of these mission areas in a broad spectrum of technologies that includes artificial intelligence, quantum sensing, simulation, computation, new mathematics, new materials and manufacturing, new approaches to design, new computational approaches. So those are sort of our four core areas that our portfolio across the agency are organized against.
And so you mentioned AI. Could you tell us a little bit about the $2 billion Next AI initiative that DARPA
Sure.
has launched and how that will be allocated?
So DARPA is actually celebrating its 60th year of existence this year. And 2 months ago at our conference to celebrate that achievement, our director announced our AI Next campaign, which is a $2 billion commitment over the next 5 years to invest in advancing the state of AI technology. We have been investing in AI since the inception of the field, almost the entire time of our existence. And we have laid, over the course of the existence of those investments, we have laid foundations for a number of technologies that we're all familiar with today, Siri, driverless vehicles. And the intent with this new announcement is to continue to build on what is already a very robust portfolio. We have over, right now, 80 programs that are either looking to advance the state of AI or leverage AI in a broad range of technologies. So we're going to look to supplement that in a way that really takes us to what we consider the third wave or the next generation of AI technologies, which will really transform, we believe, machines from being tools to more collaborative partners to augment human performance.
And how much does DARPA collaborate with private sector technology companies on its AI work?
We collaborate where it makes sense to do so. We certainly have ongoing conversations and engagements with the industry. In many cases, however, we have performance requirements that are different from what the industry, Facebooks and the Googles and Amazons and other industry, large industry investments are targeting. So where we need to make investments are in areas where we can advance the technology so that it is more robust, reliable, trusted for DoD specific and national security areas.
And David, I wanted to talk to you a little bit about what your perspective is on Washington as, you know, an executive at a 3D printing company. So you mentioned backstage that this is your first time in D.C., right?
That's right.
And so I just wanted to hear, maybe could you tell us a little bit about what your company does and how you think about the regulatory environment as sure. part of your strategy?
Absolutely. So we are a 3D printing company aimed to help professionals, whether that's a small, medium, large-sized business, or other professionals like dental professionals or in the medical industry, people who need to print for their professional life. We've started out of MIT about 7 or 8 years ago, and the goal was always to serve this purpose, make a machine that is accessible, easy to use. So we use a technology called stereolithography. It's a laser-based technology. It allows us to use a lot of different type of materials. We have 15 to 20 plastics today, also ceramic material that people can print with. It's been a really fun ride. We are now one of the biggest professional companies. We've sold about 40,000 printers, just to give you a little bit of scale. And today we are really working on pushing the boundaries on materials and applications. I think a lot of the conversation today about 3D printing is how can we really increase the scope? I think it's very obvious to everybody that 3D printing is going to have a major impact in a lot of different sectors of industry. Some people think also in kind of the personal space where they're not really directly working on that, but undoubtedly that potentially will come at one point as well, whether that's something that you can buy from Amazon or something like that. That's really interesting, downloading files, et cetera. We are right now really in the phase of scaling up our technology. And part of that is, I think, starting to impact when it comes to Washington and policymaking, more and more circles, because people have questions about how safe it is, how wide-ranging the technology can be. And we want to be part of that conversation. We are really working with almost every part of industry. Today, a lot of the conversation, I think there was a video just before about 3D printed guns. One story that we addressed this a few times, so I thought about another way to kind of think about it, which is that really you can use, this is from a professor at MIT actually, that you can use really both a gun and a shovel to obviously hurt somebody, but only one of them is great to dig a hole. And I think a really important part of 3D printing is that it's super versatile. And very similarly to some other technologies that are allowing people to manipulate digital files, the question is, where should you regulate that? And that's a lot of the conversation where it is today.
That makes sense. And Congressman, I wanted to ask you a little bit about that, because you do represent the Silicon Valley area. When we see new technologies such as 3D printing and learn about some of their applications, there's sometimes a knee-jerk reaction to regulate. I mean, can you walk me through just kind of how you think about meeting with representatives from companies that are working on tech in these emerging spaces?
Well, I think it has to be a thoughtful, balanced approach, whether it's 3D printing or artificial intelligence or quantum computing, which is going to make it possible. And while I don't understand all the details of quantum computing, I think we have to demystify some of these things. I mean, all artificial intelligence is you have large sets of data and you're trying to find a pattern. And we need sophisticated computers to do it, because you have a large set of data and ordinary computers can't do that. And so quantum computing, which has a lot of science to it that I don't understand, basically makes it possible to do these large calculations. And we need to understand why a lot of this is good. I mean, it's good that we have 3D printing in America that's going to give us a manufacturing advantage, so then more manufacturing can come here. It's good that we have artificial intelligence in many applications. If we do have some form of driverless cars, that could lessen fatalities in this country dramatically. It could allow us to diagnose diseases in ways that weren't possible because we could look at mass numbers of information. But there is obviously possibilities of abuse. For example, when you're looking at large amounts of data, do we consider a person's race or gender? And probably we don't want to do that. And that raises questions of human values. Or what is the use of artificial intelligence? I mean, there was a famous controversy recently with Google and the Department of Defense, where some of the employees said, well, we don't want this technology to make drone strikes more effective at going against terrorists because civilians are killed. And the counterargument was, well, drone strikes are going to be happening right now anyway, and maybe this will diminish the civilian casualties. So the point is, by and large, I think technology is going to advance our nation, our world, but we have to think deeply about the values, and that's where the regulation comes in, to make sure that we're regulating it in a way that's advancing our democratic values.
And Valerie, I wanted to ask you about one of the points that the congressman just made around Google employees and concerns about, you know, being working on technology that would be used for defense purposes. How has DARPA dealt with that issue, particularly as you look to attract talent, especially as, you know, some leading tech figures like Elon Musk are warning people about the dangers of using AI for warfare?
Yeah, so I'll first just point out that by directive, autonomy and AI cannot be used without human intervention, okay, for lethal engagements. I guess my response would be that we can respect Google's decision. It doesn't have to hamper us in terms of moving forward. We have innovated for 60 years in AI. The early technology, again, DARPA laid some very fundamental groundwork in the first, what we call the first wave of rules-based, and then the second wave, what Congressman was just talking about, the machine learning-enabled AI, and where we're going now in terms of, again, trying to invest in technologies that will take AI from this machine learning, which simply is looking for pattern recognition in data, to actually being, again, a collaborative partner in many human machine type of collaborative environments. And we don't see that we are having problems engaging industry in that partnership. The Google decision has not hampered DARPA's efforts to invest in the fundamental advancement of AI technology. So we're seeing in our as we were rolling out this AI Next campaign, a very good, solid response from the academic and as well nonprofit and small and large company participation. There's definitely enthusiasm for what we're trying to do, and we're finding good partnerships in that endeavor.
And Congressman, many Google employees live in your district. I mean, how do you think about these protests that we've seen when it comes to working with the government on defense issues?
Well, we're a democracy. We're not like China. I mean, China basically says they run their companies. It's state-owned. They don't care about civil liberties. They just appropriate people's data. They do whatever they want with the technology. I don't think we want to be like China. We have a system where we have free enterprise, and companies have the autonomy to decide what they want to do. DARPA has done a tremendous amount to launch Silicon Valley. I mean, if it weren't for DARPA, you probably wouldn't have had the mouse, and you may never have had Apple computers. So there is a symbiotic relationship between DARPA and tech companies, and you have the Defense Innovation Board and DIUX that is looking at how do we foster that relationship and make it closer. But I don't think we can force any company to do something they don't want. That said, I think what we have to do is address their concerns. So if Google comes out and says, well, we just don't want to collaborate on artificial intelligence with defense, I don't think that is a tenable position given the threats we face from other nations. But if they say, look, we want to be assured that there's some ethical principles and standards that are developed, and we want to be part of that in collaboration with defense, then I think that's something that we should we should work on. And my sense is more in the latter, that it's not a reflexive position that they don't want to cooperate with defense. Eric Schmidt, who chairs the Defense Innovation Board, was at Google. It's more that they want to see what are the ethical principles that are going to guide this.
And you just mentioned how DARPA funding has launched many technologies that we see in private industry. Jung-sun, could you tell us a little bit about the work that you've done with DARPA and how that spurred the work that you're doing now with your company?
Absolutely. So I think the if you look at the history of technologies that impact our lives today, they can come from different places. And I think historically in our country, it has been a large portion of that actually started out in the defense needs. For example, the first invention of digital computers that we use in our pocketbooks, in our pockets every day, that was all driven, the technology was initially driven by the needs of the defense industry. If you think about the internet, those were funded by ARPA and other places, just a different way to look at how we communicate. And these technologies were initially, they have a specific goal, but sometimes the development of industry is very different. Development of technology can actually have a much reaching impact. And when computers were built, people came and started to use that to solve their problems. And then that spurred more needs. A similar thing has happened in quantum technologies. It was a very exotic area of physics. I mean, it's fundamental in the sense that people say that the difference between quantum computer and a traditional computer, even if it's a supercomputer, is fundamentally bigger than the difference between a supercomputer and an abacus, just the way we represent information and so on. And that opens up a tremendous amount of opportunities, but in the early days, how we garner that kind of physical principles to do meaningful information processing has largely been an open question. And it's an open question of both scientific research and also technological development that we had to do to make it useful. So the efforts at DARPA and similar efforts at IARPA and so on are very targeted towards, you know, how do we garner this technology and demonstrate something that actually can lead to more meaningful, what are the next steps that are needed to get them to meaningful applications. And those were largely driven by government investments over the last couple of decades. And only in the last maybe 5 years, as I said earlier, people have built enough confidence. Maybe the private sector has now seen, if they can do that, maybe with an additional effort, a focused effort like this, maybe we'd be able to hit this target or that target. So I think the symbiotic relation that Congressman Connor mentioned is there is the need for pushing the technology forward and broad base of knowledge that we have to develop, which is academics and government can work together towards that. And then out of that, the private sector can capitalize on specific opportunities and actually try to make those happen. They will make their bets, take their risk, and manage those to try to make things happen. And I think we're right at that transition, which is a very exciting time to be.
And so we've talked about a lot of the positive things about the relationship between Silicon Valley and Washington today, as well as, you know, some of the problems too. And I think the narrative that we see a lot of attention on these days is about that tension, and people even sometimes use the word techlash. So I wanted to maybe close by doing kind of a rapid fire session right now with our panelists. If you could all each say maybe one thing that you think would improve the relationship between the tech industry and DC regulators and agencies.
We need more basic tech knowledge and competence amongst policymakers.
I think we need to manage expectations and have better communications between the industry and the policymakers so that we understand what we really need to think about as we develop new regulatory concepts.
I think going back to what Congressman said, I think hands-on experience, really not just, I think you can understand it from a textbook, but also a lot of this comes to 3D printing is very tangible. Working with the technology in some sort of application setting is very important, so there is a very holistic understanding of technology, not just a kind of surface.
The technology, advanced technology can be used for a lot of good things, and it could also be used for a lot of bad things. And as people develop technologies, I think there are ethical questions that always comes up, and those are the conversations I think we have to have with the regulatory body so that we could actually use it for more good than not good.
Got it. Well, that's all the time we have today. Thank you so much to our panelists for being here today, and thank you all for joining us today for this first Tech Realty event.
Thanks for listening. To hear more interviews from this series and other Washington Post Live programs, visit us at washingtonpostlive.com.